Hello, I'm Sherman Augustus, and this is number 0501, the Stuff Hour program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0501. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Richard Pryor Jr., who is the author of In a Prior Life. It wasn't always easy sharing a name with his comedic genius of a dad.
Yeah, it was pretty tough at times. You know, a lot of people think that it, you know, it was all good and roses and all those kind of good mushy things. And it was a lot of pain and a lot of strife of coming down to, you know, knowing who your friends were, being accepted for who you were. All those things played into being Richard Pryor Jr. It was hard to compare to your dad, and yet people wanted you to be like him and to represent yourself just like him. But then they also wanted you to be something different, totally different. So it was kind of like a no-win situation when I was coming up.
Actress Rebecca Metz stars in two TV shows, FX's Better Things and Disney Channel's hit Coop and Cammy Ask the World. She juggles playing two characters in two hit series at the same time.
This past year, I was on both shows in the same day. I would finish up at Coop and Cammy, hop in the car, race over to Better Things, and do that. And that takes a little kind of psychological adjustment, and that's a lot of work. And I have been extremely grateful to the production teams on both shows for making that work, because they didn't have to. And I think everybody understands it means a lot to me to be able to do both of those things.
Josh Frank is the author of Giraffes on Horseback Salad, which takes a look at the connection between Salvador Dali and the Marx Brothers. How did this graphic novel come to be?
When I was looking for what I should do for my next book project, I looked up lists of the greatest unmade movies, like movies that heroes of mine in cinema tried to make and didn't get made. I thought that would be really interesting to look into those histories and see if there was something that would a story worth telling. And on all the list was, in particular, Giraffes on Horseback Salad, this crazy movie idea that Salvador Dali had to have the Marx Brothers star in because he was just a huge fan.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guests later. The person who told you this was show number 0501 was actor Sherman Augustus, who plays Nathaniel Moon on the excellent AMC series Into the Badlands. That great show is airing the last 8 episodes of its 3rd and final season starting on Sunday, March 24th. Check your local listings. If you haven't watched that show, you gotta watch it. The original first seasons are also on Netflix, so you can catch up if you want to do that. And you gotta see this show. It is so much fun. And Sherman is one of the more fun characters in it as well. And an all-around nice guy. Thank you very much, Sherman, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? It seems 58-year-old Cynthia Grund is not one to back down from a challenge, particularly after her 37-year-old son had been drinking all day at her home in Salem Township, Minnesota. So when he laid down on the driveway and asked, "Why don't you just run me over?" she was happy to oblige. "He didn't believe I would. He has been drinking all day. We gave him a chance," Grund told deputies who responded to her husband's 911 call on March the 18th. Grund said she had arranged for her son to stay with a friend and was prepared to give him a ride when he stretched out on the ground. He suffered significant injuries to his head and pelvis, and Grund is accused of second-degree assault and may face an attempted murder charge. Neighbor Samuel Hafner was shocked by the incident. "They were always friendly. I would never describe them as off or malicious in any sort of way." Now, I'm sure many people will say, how could a mother do this to her own child? I've never understood that sentiment, by the way. I mean, if grown children perpetually exacerbate their parents' breaking point, anything can happen. Now, I, for instance, could never imagine my own mother running me over with a car. But then again, that's only because she couldn't drive. Yeah. An Oklahoma woman was arrested after authorities say she used a t-shirt gun to launch drugs, cell phones, and other contraband over a prison fence. The Oklahoma Department of Correction says the incident prompted a lockdown at the North Fork Correctional Unit in Sayre, which is about 120 miles west of Oklahoma City. The agency says authorities arrested Carrie Jo Hickman after discovering the t-shirt gun and another package in her vehicle. The container that was launched contained cell phones, earbuds, phone chargers, methamphetamine, digital scales, marijuana, and tobacco. Wow. All that stuff she sent into prison with a t-shirt cannon, but not one single t-shirt. Oh, the humanity. 64-year-old Joanne Cullen of North Belmore, Long Island, wants to make administrators of St. Charles Resurrection Cemetery in Farmingdale pay for the horror she experienced in December of 2016 as she visited her parents' graves. On that day, Cullen was reaching down to straighten a bow on a wreath when the ground opened up beneath her and a sinkhole caused her to fall forward and smash her head on a tombstone, cracking a tooth, according to her attorney, Joseph Perini. As Cullen sank, she grabbed the sides of the tombstone and yelled for help, but no one heard her. Cullen filed suit in March in Queens Supreme Court, asking for $5 million to overcome the nightmares and headaches she's experienced, along with the fear of walking in open fields. "I will never go back there again," Cullen said. Well, I'm assuming she means alive. Anyway, getting sucked into your parents' grave, it's terrifying and traumatizing, Perini added. Now, anybody out there now questioning the relationship she had with her parents? You know the Lord does work in mysterious ways. Yes. Paging Stephen King. Paging Stephen King. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, you know how we love our truck spills on this show. Well, here's the latest. A truck carrying 40,000 pounds of printer ink overturned on an Atlanta interstate, closing all lanes on an outer loop for 4 hours. That's 55,000 gallons or 20,820 liters of ink. News outlets report a car cut in front of the truck at around 2 a.m., causing the truck to lose control and crash. Atlanta Police's Traffic Report Twitter account says the spill stained Interstate 285 just south of Interstate 20. All lanes of I-285's outer loop were closed, while crews used sand and dirt to soak up the ink. Southbound lanes had reopened at around 6:15 a.m. But aerial video indicated the spill had left a mark. It's unclear, by the way, whether anyone was injured or to whom the ink belonged. Well, the obvious solution to getting rid of the mark would be to dump a whole lot of liquid paper or whiteout. Problem solved. You know, maybe the guy in the car who cut him off has a problem with the press. You know what they've always said, never get into an argument with someone who buys ink by the barrel. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? There's a new book out called In a Prior Life. It's written by Richard Pryor Jr., the son of the legendary comedian. The book shares the story of his life and the relationship with his father. Richard joins us on the line right now from New York. Hi, Richard.
Hello, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you for having me.
So you've written this book now, at this point in your life. I would assume that throughout the course of your life, I mean, your father was larger than life and an icon. Was it difficult being saddled with the name Richard Pryor Jr.?
Yeah, it was pretty tough at times.
you know, a lot of people think that it, you know, it was all good and you know, roses and all those kind of good mushy things, and it was a lot of pain and a lot of strife of, you know, coming down to, you know, knowing who your friends were, being accepted for who you were. All those things played into being Richard Pryor Jr. You know, it was hard to compare to your dad, and yet people wanted you to be like him and to represent yourself just like him. But then they also wanted you to be something different, totally different. So it was kind of like a no-win situation when I was coming up.
Stories are that when one deals with a family situation, everyone rebels against their parents. But your dad was, in effect, such a rebel himself. How did you, if at all, rebel from being Richard Pryor's son?
I think my thing was, and not knowing that I was following in the same footsteps, was actually getting into the drugs, doing the female impersonating. All those things, I think, contributed to me trying to be my own person and to be something totally different than what people expected me to be. I think society puts a label on you, wants you to keep you in that. And I just wanted to be my own person. And I think that shows as far as my life is concerned.
Well, let's talk a little bit about being your own person. I mean, I believe you were in the military at one point.
Yes, I was.
And you were also a female impersonator.
Yeah.
You've also been heavily involved in religion. You were a pastor.
Right.
So how did these various roads, because when all these things happened, your dad was still alive. So how did these various roads affect, if at all, your relationship with your father?
Well, it didn't. My father was always my father. You know, no matter what I did, even if it was something that he did not agree with, he never let me know that he wasn't satisfied with something that I was doing. He always told me whatever I did, be the best at it and do the best I could at it, always. So that's the way I live my life as far as everything that I've done, even through all the journeys that I've taken throughout my life, trying to find out who I was.
Now, when your father passed away, there were some people who actually blamed you for it?
Yeah, I actually had a website that was one of those online media things. They took some pictures of me from when I did a film as a female impersonator. I did a film, and they took those pictures and said I was a transvestite. And the people in the comments and things, they were actually blaming me for his death. No wonder he died. No wonder he had a heart attack, that I have to have a son like that. And it was just a horrible thing that I had to endure.
And how did you survive that situation? I mean, you're in a situation where you're already grieving and now you're being blamed for something like this. How did you deal with that?
I think it was a part of my life. I was already at the part of my life where I knew who I was as a person. I knew the kind of person I was. I knew my heart and I knew my soul, my spirit and all those things. So I think those are the things of knowing who I was are the things that really helped me, and I loved myself. So I think those are the things that really helped me get through this during those times.
What made you write this book now?
I had been through so much in my life, and I was like, hey, I came out, and I'm still smiling, and I'm still here, and I love myself. I want to tell my story so that maybe other people that are going through something, because when you go through things in your life, you think you're the only person that goes through it. And I wanted to put a face onto something so people could see and recognize, hey, this guy supposedly has everything because of who his father was, but look at the things that he's went through, but look what he came out of. He came out of all those dark spots in his life, and he's happy now, and he's living his life, and I wanted people to see some hope.
What are the best memories you have of your relationship with your dad?
Going on the road with my father when he was doing stand-up and introducing him on stage. I think those are my best moments. And also the private times I had with my dad when we would go to the movies and watch films. When nobody knew who he was in the audience and everything, we would go there and sit there, come in after the film started and sit down and watch movies and eat candy and popcorn and drink sodas. Those are the best moments I had.
We all have this image of Richard Pryor from the films, from the stand-up, from the times he was guests on on talk shows. What is something about Richard Pryor that we don't know that would surprise us, especially considering you got to see the private side of him as his son?
Well, one thing I know that my father sang very, very, very well. He's a very good singer. I know that. But also a lot of things that people don't know is that my father was very quiet. And he wasn't the person that, you know, told jokes all the time. You saw that on stage, but when he was off stage, he was a very quiet man, and he was just a dad, wanting to be a dad and, you know, make sure he raised his children right.
You mentioned some of the difficulties you've had in your life. First of all, are you happy with who you are right now?
Oh, I'm very happy.
Do you feel
very happy? Life takes us on a journey, and I'm on that journey and on that ride no matter where it takes me.
Do you feel you had to go through all that you went through in life to be at this happy moment now? In other words, that you are the sum of all your experiences?
Yes, totally. I had to go through some things in order to find out who I actually was in life. So, those things, although a lot of the things were horrible and horrendous, I had to go to those things in order to be to where I am now and to appreciate the things that I've gone through.
So what do you believe your biggest life lesson has been?
My biggest lifelong lesson is learning to love yourself. Learning to not take what people say at face value. Knowing that not everybody is going to like you and not everybody is going to care about you. And not everybody is going to be your friend. And learning to take those things and forgiving people for yourself, not for them, but for yourself, to be able to move on in life.
You already mentioned that your dad said, be the best at whatever you set your mind to do. Obviously, he's not with us anymore, but how do you think he'd feel about you writing this book now?
Well, I think my father would be happy with it because he's always told me to be my truth, live my truth. So I think he would be happy with it because I'm telling my story and telling the things I went through. It's not just a story about him. It's about my life and the things I've had to endure in life.
And who do you feel, do you still feel, I should say, that again, your name is Richard Pryor Jr. Do you think that some people are going to pick up this book because they want to know more about your father, or they really want to know about you?
I'm sure some people are going to pick it up out of curiosity because of who my father was. I'm sure that's going to happen. But during the time that they do this, when they pick the pages up and start reading it, they're going to find out who I am as a person.
You were raised by your mother and grandparents, right?
Yes, correct.
Your dad was basically on tour a lot at that time in your life.
Right, right.
Was there pride? Was there resentment? How did you feel about your father being away? Or did you just enjoy the fact that, you know, your dad was someone who was beloved by a large swath of the population?
Well, it took me a while to understand exactly what my father was because I've always looked at it like my dad worked at a factory because that's all I've ever known. So I didn't see him the way the world did. But when I got older, I truly appreciated and understood what he did, and he had to do what he had to do for himself because of what he loved to do. And it would be horrible for me to want someone to stop doing that, to live their life, especially after I've gotten older and understand that myself.
I mentioned the various things that you have been doing in the past. You were in the military, as you said. You were a drag artist. You were a minister. What are you doing now, besides this book? What are you doing these days?
Right now, I'm actually back in ministry, doing that again. I'm in church again. And my ex-wife, who's actually been mentioned in my book, I talk about in my book, is actually my pastor now. So that's the journey I'm on now, is being a better me, the best I can be.
It seems like throughout the course of your life, you have a vision to help others. Would that be accurate?
Oh, that's totally accurate. That's always been a part of the kind of person I am. I think I got that from my mother, as far as being the person that's always wanting to be the caretaker, always being the person that wants to take care of somebody and nurture people. So that's what I'm actually doing the best way I knew how to do right now.
And no desires, although one could say that one being a minister, one being a pastor, you are in show business every Sunday at least. But are there any thoughts or ideas of being back in the limelight on stage in either a singer or even a comedian?
Oh, definitely. As far as performing, that's always been a part of my life, and that's never going to change. You know, I love performing. I love singing in front of people. I love acting in front of people. My thing now is taking this book, and I'm trying to create a one-man show based off of the book now and the characters in the book.
Well, good luck with that, and congratulations on the book. The book is called In a Prior Life. Richard, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Richard Pryor Jr., author of In a Prior Life. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0501, and you'll find links to Richard's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File, now with 25% fewer calories. Here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to actress Rebecca Metz, who stars in not one, but two television shows, Josh Frank, who is the author of Giraffes on Horseback Salad, and of course there is an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? 21-year-old Arby's manager Letaria Atkins was arrested in Royal Palm Beach, Florida, for aggravated assault, battery, and criminal mischief on March 16th after an altercation with Ernst Pondujour, an employee. The trouble started after Atkins asked Pondujour if he could work late that evening. When he refused, the two began arguing, and witnesses reported that as Pondujour got very close to Atkins, she pepper-sprayed him. Pondujour ran out of the building with Atkins in hot pursuit, wielding a long kitchen knife. Police said Atkins did not stab Pondujour, but did scratch his car with the knife. Is this how overtime is discussed in Florida? Wow. Yes, Jerry Bradley, this is yet another story that hails from the Sunshine State. You know, folks from around the world seem to squeal like schoolgirls over these Florida stories. Listeners to the Stuff File program on WLSLLP Dade City, Florida, probably not so much. Yeah. Topeka, Kansas police took the joy out of Joyride on March 16th for 40-year-old Nicholas Hodgden, who climbed into a forklift outside a Dillon's grocery store that evening and set off down the road. The forklift, valued at $1,500, had been left outside the store with the keys in the ignition. A spokesperson for the police department says bystanders saw what happened and called police, who apprehended Nicky as he drove along holding an open can of beer. He also had a six-pack in the back. Hodgden was booked into the Shawnee County Jail on one count of felony theft and misdemeanor counts of driving under the influence and transporting an open alcoholic beverage container. You know, over the years, we've had people take joyrides by stealing forklifts, steamrollers, snowblowers, tractors, police cars, and school buses, to say the least. Who says vehicle theft is always dull, huh? Yeah. Now, if you think government workers are lazy, wait until you hear this. Thanks to a government-funded conceptual art project in Gothenburg, Sweden, a person will be hired for a permanent position to do absolutely nothing. The employee in question will report to Koshvajin, a train station still under construction in the city, and will receive a salary of about $2,320 a month in U.S. dollars, plus annual wage increases, vacation time off, and a pension for retirement. Retiring from what, when you think about it? Yeah, anyway, the job requirements couldn't be more simple. An employee shows up each morning and punches the time clock. At the end of the day, the worker returns to clock out. In between, they can do whatever they want aside from working at another paying job. They're not even obliged to stay at the station all day long. And their employment is guaranteed for life. While the artists behind the project won't be taking applications until the station will be closer to opening, a draft of the Help Wanted ad is already available online. Oh, and anyone in the world can apply. You just have to then live in Sweden. Okay, is this a unionized job? And if so, what if you aren't happy with the working conditions and decide to go on strike? How will anybody know? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the last thing Ohio defense attorney Aaron Brockler remembers after hearing the judge pronounce a 47-year sentence for his client, 42-year-old David Chiselton, was a swoosh sound. That was the sound of Chiselton's fist speeding through the air toward Brockler's face. On February 19th, Chiselton had pleaded guilty in Cuyahoga County to domestic abuse, aggravated arson, felonious assault, and cruelty to a companion animal, and Commons Plea Court Judge Nancy Margaret Russo handed down his sentence as he stood handcuffed next to his lawyer. But before Brockler could tell him that he would try to get the sentence reduced, Chiselton had knocked him to the floor. "All I remember is waking up on the floor underneath the table," Brockler said. Brockler suffered a concussion and a broken nose. Needless to say, Chiselton faces additional charges. Well, if David manages to keep his temper under wraps during his incarceration and maintains good behavior, he'll see freedom somewhere before his 90th birthday. By then, I'm sure Aaron's nose will have healed sufficiently. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Actress Rebecca Metz is here on the show. She has the recurring role as Tressa, a talent manager and Sam's friend on the FX series Better Things. Plus, she's a regular on the Disney Channel hit Coop and Cammy Ask the World. And she also guested on many shows through the years, so she's been busy. And we're thankful that she took a few moments out of her busy schedule to be here on this show with us. Rebecca joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for being on the program with us. Would it be best to characterize you as a character actress?
I think so. I've always been a little fuzzy on what that means because we all play characters. But yeah, I think whatever it means, that's what I am.
Since you do so many things and you've been on so many shows, when people meet you in the street, do they know you from the various shows you've been on? Or do they think that you're somebody they went to school with?
Yeah. Until now, what I have mostly gotten is people just kind of like staring at me for a weirdly long time and then sort of going like, "I know you." And then I have to decide if I'm going to say, "Well, I'm on TV sometimes," or... Because sometimes you do that and then you figure out where they know you from and that's fun. Or you say that and then they're like, "No, we have the same dentist," and then you feel stupid. So I try to navigate it. Although I will say in the last, you know, year or two, people have started to know where they know me from and to say, "I love Better Things," or "My kids love Coop and Cammy," or whatever it is, which takes a little bit of the pressure off of me.
Well, let's talk about your current work. Let's start first off with FX's critically acclaimed series, Better Things. Tell us about the role you play of Tressa.
So Tressa is the lead character of Sam, who is played by Pamela Adlon, and the whole thing is kind of a semi-autobiographical spin on her life, is a single working mom and a working actor, which Pam is also. And Tressa plays her manager, her talent manager. Tressa is also sort of in her inner circle of close friends who are kind of always around the house and helping raise the kids and helping her navigate all of the crazy situations she gets into. So Tressa is a big part of both her business life and her professional life.
And the role you play on Coop and Cammy Ask the World is also a single mom, correct?
Yeah, she's also a single working mom. So Coop and Cammy is a Disney Channel show, obviously a bit of a different audience and a bit of a different tone. That's a multi-camera show, kind of sitcom style. And Jenna Rather, who I play, is the mother of the four Rather kids, including Coop and Cammy. She is a single mom who is a real estate agent. Dad on the show passed away 2 years before the pilot, and so we find that out in the pilot that Jenna's going to start dating again. And it's really fun because I get to kind of show, and it's a little different than I think Disney Channel moms in the past. We get to kind of show Jenna have a bit of a personal life and show her at work and navigating what it really means to be a single working mom. So that's, it's really fun.
Now, with these two roles, you've been playing these roles for a bit now. They're recurring or regular roles that you're playing here. So from that perspective, since you're playing two different roles, what is it that Rebecca brings to these two characters? And what does Rebecca take away from these two characters to add to her personal life?
Oh, I love that question. I think each of them, I think with any role, we, as actors, kind of get to bring some aspect of our personality forward. I think we're all, you know, complex people. So depending on what the writing and the character brings out and requires, you sort of bring that side of your personality forward. So in Better Things really kind of bounces between comedy and not drama, but emotions. There's a lot of feelings in that show. And so sometimes we're in tears, sometimes we're laughing hysterically, sometimes we're doing both. It requires a lot more sort of grounded, like real world, just connecting with the other actors and getting into the kind of situations that happen in life. Whereas Coop and Cammy is a much more theatrical feeling. It's classic sitcom comedy. So I get to play with a lot more of those comedy skills and theater skills, which is really fun. As far as what I take away from them in my life, on Coop and Cammy, I actually have a very good friend from all the way back to high school who has four kids and lost her husband to a terminal illness and is a single working mom. And so when this role came up for me, it felt like a really important opportunity to give her kids a chance to see a family like theirs on television, which means a lot to me, and just for single moms to get to see themselves and see someone in a family who's making it work and having a good time and not being perfect, but you know, raising her kids really successfully and managing everything. So that, I mean, it's actually really fulfilling in that way. And Better Things, I'm just watching Pam. She is running the writer's room, directing every episode, starring in every episode. It's based on her life, show running, editing. It's so she is running that ship, and I am watching her like a hawk every second so that I can maybe follow in her footsteps someday.
As an actress, you have effortlessly traveled the scope from drama to comedy. Do you have a preference between the two?
I think I probably lean a little towards comedy. And even when I'm doing drama, I tend to get hired to do things that have a little bit of a sense of humor in them. Not always. But I think my favorite kind of work is work that has a little bit of both in it, because I think life is like that. You know, life isn't always comedy or always drama. And often there's a little bit of the other mixed in, no matter what's going on. So I really like that kind of thing, and I tend to do that kind of thing. I was on Shameless for a few seasons, which in, you know, awards consideration has bounced back and forth between drama and comedy, because it really isn't either one all the time. And that's the kind of stuff that I like the most.
You often hear from people from various age groups that this is the golden age of movies, or this is the golden age of television. I really do think we are in a golden age of television right now. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. Yeah. I came out here after college just when The Sopranos was starting, and kind of had this feeling that something was changing, something special was happening. And I'm pretty excited that I was kind of right. I think we really are in a golden age of television.
As I mentioned, you've been in a lot of things. Just going through your list of credits, Nip Tuck, This Is Us, Grey's Anatomy, For the People, Bones, Major Crimes, The Mentalist, Boston Legal, one of my favorite shows of all time, Southland, Californication, the list goes on and on and on.
It kind of does. It's, when you say it all in a row like that, I sort of go, wow, that really is a lot of shows.
So when will we get a chance with all the work you've done, and you're currently in a couple of series right now and doing very well, but when will we get to see a show that is structured completely around you where you're the lead?
That is a fantastic question that my family has been asking since before I went to school for acting. I don't know. I mean, I think, I don't know. I don't even know that that's necessarily my goal, although if something like that came along, obviously I would jump on it. I just want to be part of great projects with great writing and great people that keep challenging me and keep being fulfilling to work on. That's what I want. Wherever I am in that, I'm happy. Although we'll see if that changes. Maybe I'll decide I really do want something that's all about me. Call me back in a year.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, we're living in a time now where women are very empowered when it comes to working. They are writers and directors and producers, and they're creating their own projects. In your dream of dreams, what's the perfect Rebecca Metz role that hasn't been created yet that you would love to do?
I mean, maybe I'm about to completely contradict myself. I would love to be more central to a story only because I think I've always played, and character actors in general, and especially female character actors, I think have always tended to be kind of on the circumference and showing up and chiming in and doing something funny and then leaving while the central story goes on. And I think with shows like Better Things and Shrill that just came out on Hulu and a lot of what's going on in television, we're starting to see those kinds of characters at the center of the story, which is kind of cathartic. And for me anyway, has made me think like, you know, I never realized that I wanted this until I'm seeing it. And I never realized I was missing it until it's happening now. And I'm going, oh yeah, I would like people like me at the center of a story. So, I mean, now is kind of the time for that kind of thing to happen, and I'm here for it.
Working on two shows at the same time, do your shooting schedules ever overlap? Like one day you're in one show and the next day you're in another?
Yeah, this past year I was on both shows in the same day. I would finish up at Coop and Cammy, hop in the car, race over to Better Things and do that. And that's, you know, takes a little kind of psychological adjustment. And that's a lot of work, and I have been extremely grateful to the production teams on both shows for making that work, because they didn't have to, and I think everybody understands it means a lot to me to be able to do both of those things. But yeah, the schedule can get pretty hectic. It's like nice problems to have. You know, I have too many acting jobs to juggle. I will never complain about that. I'm always just trying to find a way to make it work so that I don't have to say no to anything that I love.
Having to juggle them both at the same time, is that where your Carnegie Mellon School of Drama education comes in handy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes in handy all the time, but particularly going like, okay, I have to get out of this mindset, out of this set of lines, and into this other mindset and this other set of situations. And I am always trying to remember which set I can curse on and which set I can't curse on. That's a very important distinction for me that I'm always trying to keep track of.
FX, yes. Disney, no.
Exactly.
Well, since you're so busy, I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with us and talk a little bit. Thank you very much, Rebecca, for being on the program with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Actress Rebecca Metz. You can see her on the FX series Better Things and also on the Disney Channel hit Coop and Cammy Ask the World. Check your local listings. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0501, and you'll find links to Rebecca's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Would you believe that in the state of Nebraska, you need more training to massage a horse than a human? It's true. If you rub down a horse without a license, you could spend 4 years in jail. And in Michigan, it's illegal to shampoo hair for someone outside your family without a cosmetology license. Getting that license requires a 2-year apprenticeship or 1,500 hours of training. That's the same number of hours of training the Federal Aviation Authority requires for airline pilots.
Let's be fair, it's time to fix this system. When a license isn't needed to protect public health, it can simply act as a barrier for people who need jobs. Among those hurt by these laws are military families, who often move from state to state and find that a non-military spouse can no longer work without spending months getting a new license. To generate more awareness of this problem, we're collecting examples of unneeded licensing laws. If you have an example, send it to us at centerforamericatv.org.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Giraffes on Horseback Salad. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And we have one more Stuff File news story that I want to share with you. Here on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. This show, of course, being the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the author of Great Conversations, my interview with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars, a book that is still available. You can find it on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca, and, of course, at my publisher's website, which is Bear Manor Media. Go to BearManorMedia.com. There you go. Okay, Michigan police were called after midnight on reports of numerous gunshots. Arriving on the scene, officers found a 37-year-old Hancock man standing outside his vehicle, which was stuck in a snowbank. Officer investigation revealed the man was intoxicated. They also found numerous bullet casings on the ground. After a search of the vehicle, officers found and confiscated a Glock 9mm pistol. It appeared the shots had been fired into the snowbank. The man was arrested and lodged at the Houghton County Jail. The snow was unharmed. What exactly was his point at shooting at a snowbank? You know, usually when you shoot at something and hit it, the result, or at least the end result, is it no longer has the capacity to move on its own. Mind you, maybe this guy thought that shooting an inanimate object that couldn't move would cause the reverse to happen. What this case, or in this situation, casings, shows is that this is another example of there just being too many guns. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Fans of the Marx Brothers who want to take a deep dive into their work and history might find it interesting to check out the graphic novel Giraffes on Horseback Salad. It's co-written by Josh Frank and tells the tale of the Marx Brothers, Salvador Dali, and a movie that was never made. Josh joins us via Skype from Austin, Texas. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. There are so many books out there about the Marx Brothers, but you seem to have found a niche about this little hidden treasure of a movie that was never made that involves Salvador Dali. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so, you know, when I was looking for what I should do for my next book project, I looked up lists of, like, the greatest unmade movies, like movies that heroes of mine in cinema, you know, tried to make and didn't get made, because I thought that would be really interesting to look into those histories and see if there was something that would, like, a story worth telling. And on all the list was, in particular, Giraffes on Horseback Salad, this crazy movie idea that Salvador Dali had to have the Marx Brothers star in, because he was just a huge fan of their movies, and particularly he just adored and idolized Harpo.
Of all the Marx Brothers, Harpo. Why Harpo?
Because he felt that Harpo sort of embodied, like, the true spirit of surrealism, you know, in human form, and he was just unbridled surreal. And he wanted to meet Harpo and finally got the opportunity at a party in Paris in 1937 when he was touring Europe for his Night at the Opera promotional tour. And they struck up, you know, a friendship and corresponded through the mail for about 6 months. At one point, Dali sent Harpo a surrealist harp, like a real harp, but it was covered in cellophane, wrapped in cellophane, and had barbed wire strings. And so Harpo responded, sent back to Dali a picture of his hands bandaged in front of the harp, and invited Dali to come visit him and have them paint each other. And Dali took him up on it and went out to Hollywood with the idea of breaking into the Hollywood business with surrealism and meeting, you know, and painting Harpo.
when it comes to surreal, I mean, you look up surreal and you see a picture of Dali. He is just so surreal. But just the idea of where the ideas come from, let's just start with the title, Giraffes on Horseback Salad. What does that even mean?
Well, I've been working on this for 6 years, and your guess is as good as mine. But my theory on why he picked that is that it sounded like a Marx Brothers movie that Dali would make. You know, there's a night at the opera, there's a day at the races, you know, there's Animal Crackers. So to me, it's like his surrealist title showing love for, you know, how the Marx Brothers movie names sound, you know, Giraffes on Horseback Salad, you know. So to me, it's sort of this rhythmic thing that sort of connects the Marx Brothers movie canon to surrealism.
Now, you've delved into this. This movie was never made. Delving into the story of it, does it not surprise you that this movie was never made?
It doesn't surprise me that it wasn't made then. It would surprise me if someone saw the version that we created and didn't see, oh my God, this could be a movie, because it totally could. Like, I think in today's world, people would like get it because people have grown accustomed to the strange and unusual with Terry Gilliam and David Lynch and, you know, I mean, really crazy, weird stuff. This is no different than that. You know, in fact, I find the story that's come out of the adaptation to be quite accessible. Now, Dali's original version in his mind probably was not going to be as accessible as what the final product is. However, when I wrote the adaptation, my the standards I gave myself for how to write it was, what would Irving Thalberg do? Hmm. Irving Thalberg was the studio head at the time that if he hadn't have passed away shortly before they pitched this, he might have allowed Harpo to experiment because he really liked the Marx Brothers a lot and he had the power to do so. Unfortunately, he passed away before they pitched. And when they pitched, it was to the new studio head who loathed the Marx Brothers. So my whole theory was if Thalberg had have been there and had have greenlit it, he would have then been in charge of wrangling Dali, and he would have done everything in his power to make it an accessible Hollywood movie in some fashion.
Okay, so we're going back to a film that wasn't made 80 years ago.
Right.
How did you come to find the script to then work on an adaptation of it?
I spent a couple of years combing through the different museums that had archives of Dali's writing, and I reached out to them one at a time to find out if by chance there might be one that had any of his original, you know, notes or writings having to do with his movie projects. And I found one museum in Paris that had sort of a gold mine for me of like 80 handwritten pages that all involve Giraffes on Horseback Salad ideas. And I had that translated into English, and I used that as my decoder for what this movie really would have been.
What, and again, it's a surreal topic, so it might be, it's not difficult to do the 30-second elevator pitch, but what is the story of this?
Well, in a nutshell, part of the way I found what I think the true meaning behind the story was I looked at Dali's life at that time. He was a refugee. He had fled a land of war. He had come to America, an amazing country, but a country very steeped in reality, you know, very steeped in the opposite of surrealism. And so he was very troubled at that time and going through a lot artistically, like sort of very unsure of himself. So I think he embedded that in his main character of Jimmy, who's this businessman who comes to America and strikes it rich and basically creates this huge business industry, owns a huge tower in New York City, but he's kind of lost and trying to find himself and sort of a dreamer but stuck in reality. And he meets this woman who is the surrealist woman who can conjure any of her dreams or imagination and make them real. And so it's sort of about this war between reality and fantasy, and it's a love story. And the Marx Brothers are sort of the surrealist woman's sidekicks. It's kind of an epic tale as Dali wanted it to be. He had this vision of, you know, just like a huge, huge Hollywood movie, you know, like Ten Commandments Hollywood movie, you know, like epic scenes of grandeur. And but yeah, it's really a simple story of discovering who you are and breaking free of the chains that hold you to the ground.
Your book is a graphic novel, which means it's visual. We're talking about Salvador Dali, who is a surrealist. Is your book and Dali's style, do they mesh?
Absolutely. I found an amazing illustrator in Spain. So, you know, again, I was going for complete authenticity with this. So I found a Spanish illustrator, a young, amazing woman. This is her sort of breakout project. What's amazing about her is she has the ability to conjure Dali's vibe, but it's all original. She makes it her own. It's not too on the nose, you know, so it's still original and it's still its own thing. It's amazing. Like every page is a piece of art, like what she's done.
Who would get the most out of this book in your estimation? Marx Brothers fans or Dali fans or the general population? Who are you striving for when you put this book together?
You know, I wasn't just striving for Dali fans or Marx Brothers fans. To me, that was going to be a bonus. You know, that there's already a fan base, you know, like there's already people, you know, that were going to be interested, you know, if they're fans of Dali or the Marx Brothers. I wanted to do fan service to them and nail the Marx Brothers and nail Dali as far as, you know, authenticity and, you know, having true fans appreciate it. But I wanted the overall book to be something that was accessible to everyone. In fact, part of my goal when I first got my book deal for this, my son hadn't been born. In fact, I got the book deal the week that my son was born, and I knew it was going to take 2 or 3 years, you know, to get it to publication. So my goal actually was to be able to sit down with my 3-year-old son and have him find something to appreciate on the page. You know, like that was my watermark. And so it was really cool. When I got my first copy, I sat down in bed with him and I said, this is a book and it's about giraffes. You know, and I opened the pages and he loved it, you know. That is not to say that it's not a children's book. It deals with very big stuff, but just the fact that the imagery can be appreciated in that way on such a base level, like that was kind of what I was going for. And the story itself, I think, is accessible could be, you know, there's something to connect with, you know, I think with anybody, because it's really about sort of a struggle and it's about, you know, finding yourself.
The book is called Giraffes on Horseback Salad. Josh, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
I thank you for taking the time to have me on very much.
Josh Frank, co-author of Giraffes on Horseback Salad. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0501, and you'll find links to Josh's site, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now, boys and girls, for the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
52-year-old Michael Walters was arrested after being accused of stealing more than $6,500 from his team in Manchester, New Jersey, and then robbing a bank in neighboring Berkeley in order to pay it back. Police said he also used his government-owned vehicle from his job with the state's Child Welfare Agency as a getaway vehicle. Police first became involved when coaches and team representatives for the local boys 10 under travel baseball team contacted them about their worries that Walters may have been pilfering funds that were meant for equipment, traveling expenses, and other team fees. Their suspicions were raised when Walters was unable to pay one of the team's fundraising winners. The next day, Walters arrived at the Manchester police station and told officers that he had come into a large amount of cash, which he was able to use to pay back the team. Now it was the police's suspicions that were raised. Officers in Manchester were already aware that their colleagues in Berkeley were investigating a robbery of a bank. Police there said a heavily disguised masked bandit walked into the bank, handed a teller a note demanding money, and walked out with cash. Manchester police called Berkeley police to tell them about Walter's newfound cash. Using residential surveillance video, Berkeley police said they matched Walter's vehicle, which belongs to the Division of Child Protection and Permanency, an agency that pays Walter's a $57,400 base salary, with a car, and that car was seen near the bank. They said the car was a perfect match. Berkeley police got a search warrant at about 11 p.m. and said they found money and items used in the robbery in the car. Walters was arrested and charged with second-degree robbery in connection to the bank and theft of deception and issuing a bad check for more than $500 in connection to the team. Okay, this is a long trip down the moron trail because why, oh why, would you try to cover up your theft of funds meant for a boys' baseball team by going to a nearby town, robbing a bank, using your company car as a getaway vehicle, coming back to your town to tell the cops that you suddenly came into some money to pay for the funds that you originally pilfered, all in a convoluted plot that would immediately have been turned down as too ludicrous by Lucy Ricardo on I Love Lucy more than 60 years ago? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0501. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0501. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.